10. Deal or No Deal. Falling out with Carl Williams, 2003 to 2006. It was December 2003. Carl and Roberta Williams had welcomed their first and only child, Dakota, into the world 2 years earlier, and they wanted to celebrate with everybody, now that Carl was not in jail. So they hosted a $150,000 christening bash at Crown Casino. Vanessa Amorosi belted out tracks, and the master of ceremonies was Carl Williams's dependable lawyer, Nicola Gobbo. Dowsley later found a photo, now infamous, of Gobbo at this event, her arms around Carl Williams and Benji Venuman, her breasts spilling out of her skimpy dress. Next to Venuman, she looked like a female basketballer alongside a jockey. He'd evidently made up with Gobbo since she had represented Louis Moran in July 2003, and Venuman had called her a fucking dog. A swag of lawyers attended the event, though Gobbo later said she was the only one stupid enough to make a speech. The police heard every word. "I've been asked to make a special thank you that Carl could be with us tonight," she said. Gobbo offered a mock toast to the boys at Piranha, and especially Stuart Bateson. Gobbo didn't feel so silly at the time. She was the focus of jubilation. Her client, Carl Williams, was rapidly building a reputation for criminal grandeur. He was on stage beside her, deferring to her banter. Roberta Williams was miffed by the ease with which Gobbo stole the attention. She felt Gobbo overwhelmed her daughter's event. Gobbo was by then a pseudo-member of Williams's crew, a fixture at lunch and dinner meetings, some at the fast food restaurants Williams preferred. On the morning of the christening, she had visited Paul Dale in prison, during which Dale said, according to her, that he would have attended the event if he could, and he didn't care what the police thought. In a few months, he and Williams, according to the latter, would allegedly plan the murder of Terry Hodson, and Gobbo would act as a go-between for the two men. Gobbo had known Williams since 2002. She met him and his father George after Mockbell pointed out Carl in Port Phillip Prison. She would go on to represent both father and son on various charges between 2003 and 2005. She met them for coffees, she later said, though she did not frequent nightclubs with Carl, as other lawyers did. She accepted a burner phone from Williams's associate, whom Dowsley and Carl Lyon call the European. The Williamses wanted to be able to speak to their lawyer without having police listen in. Williams trusted Gobbo, even if his wife didn't. As Roberta Williams now describes it, Gobbo just materialized one day and ensconced herself. Gobbo acted like one of the boys, and the boys didn't betray Carl. Gobbo's role was to help him stay out of jail. Why would he suspect that she was actually trying to put him in jail? Around the time of Dakota's christening, Gobbo was on the point of snitching to Bateson, but had recently defended Williams in a hearing related to Bateson. Carl and Roberta really didn't like Bateson. Stewie turned up on their doorstep so often that they reserved a chair for him in their living room, set apart from the other furniture. In a tapped phone call to a mate in Barwon Prison, Williams had allegedly threatened to kill Bateson and chop up his girlfriend. During Carl's arrest at Port Melbourne on the 17th of November 2003, Age newspaper photographer Angela Wiley famously captured Williams's scowl as he lay handcuffed on the ground, like hog-tied game. Gobbo, as Williams's lawyer, sounded outraged in the courtroom when his case came to trial. She applied an odd logic reserved for defence barristers. She wanted to cross-examine Bateson's girlfriend, because the girlfriend's claim to being extremely scared did not necessarily mean she feared for her life. Williams was bailed just 2 days before his daughter's christening. He never suspected Bateson and his lawyer were growing allies rather than adversaries. Yet Gobbo's best work in putting Williams away for life would be done at Barwon Prison's maximum security Acacia unit, soon to be known as the Deal or No Deal unit. This was no Hotel California, a la the Eagles ballad. You could check out at any moment, as in be killed, but you could leave too. As Shifty the Supergrass would show, you could walk into Acacia after confessing to a few murders and ask to be home in a decade. Shifty, also known as the Driver, drove the getaway car at the Jason Moran and Pasquale Barbaro killing, and the murder 4 months later of Michael Marshall outside his home in South Yarra. The assassin pulled the trigger both times. Shifty was Supergrass number one in the gangland race of the rats. He was considered so critical that he merited a personal visit from Assistant Commissioner Simon Overland in maximum security prison. The assassin was Supergrass number two. There's nothing new about police strategies that induce one criminal to snitch on his criminal mates in the hope of setting off a domino effect. But nowhere has the duplicity of a criminal lawyer been intrinsic to the scheme. Gobbo gave legal advice to both Shifty and the assassin, because they were fellow members of Williams's crew. Shifty's early days read like a page from a handbook for creating a monster. His parents were Nazi sympathisers. One, or both of them, held his head underwater to stop his habit of holding his breath. He was a target of bullies at school. He began misbehaving as a child, triggering a pattern of aberrance that a psychiatrist would call a pursuit of validation. He became violent and abusive. Yet Shifty defied hitman stereotypes. He blended in and went unnoticed in a chameleon-like guise of normality. "What went wrong?" Bateson asked him following his arrest. "Ah, when you don't get a chance at one sort of life," he replied. "People fall into other things." Shifty took up ice. He fell in with Carl Williams, who by then was obsessed with exterminating the Moran family. Williams had recruited the assassin when the pair were in prison together. The assassin was in jail again when Williams rang him, mouthing off about Bateson and his girlfriend. The assassin and Shifty, who claimed he did not like guns, became one of the top three hit teams of gangland. If you came across Shifty in the street, you wouldn't pick him as a hitman, one close observer would tell Dowsley and Carlyon. If you came across the assassin, you would run the other way. The killing of Michael Marshall, a hot dog vendor, on the 25th of October 2003, was recorded by police as it happened. The hitmen were suspects in the earlier Moran killing, and police had bugged Shifty's car. Investigators knew the pair were planning something. They had returned dozens of times to the same South Yarra block where Marshall lived, but police were unsure whether Shifty and the assassin were contemplating a burglary, an armed robbery, or a hit. When the shots were fired, detectives heard muffled bangs via the car bug, but to this day say that the positional tracker on the vehicle was not working at the critical moment, that the tracker, but not the audio, dropped out for 7 minutes was a quirk of fate that even Piranha's bosses wondered at. Simon Overland says one of the investigators was paranoid that we were prepared to let the murder take place. He came to the task force officers and demanded to hear the recording. Investigators heard the assassin and Shifty in the adrenaline-soaked minutes after the kill. "Should I ring the big fella?" the assassin asked. He later did, and told Williams, in what would become one of gangland's most notorious quotes, that, "I think that horse got scratched." The pair were arrested by heavily armed police at a pub the same day. Shifty was giving up little, despite the evidence against him. He spoke to Piranha detectives in November 2003. A few weeks in custody had been ample time for him to weigh up his options. The case against him was strong. He was going to jail for a long time. But he wanted to barter. He had information that implicated those further up the chain. He wanted to become a supergrass. It was the first crack in what Gobbo would describe in a 2015 letter to Police Brass as the underworld's damn wall of silence. Shifty sat in a white Commodore for the trip from Melbourne's custody centre to the St Kilda Road police complex. He hadn't eaten for 3 days when he spoke to Bateson and other detectives. The record button was secretly switched on for the car ride. Police routinely chat to prisoners outside of the official interview and use the conversation as evidence against the suspect. Bateson tried to establish a rapport, asking if Shifty had lost weight. He'd heard from Gobbo that her client was on a hunger strike. Did Shifty want food? Bateson asked, "I'll get you whatever you want." Here began a masterclass in suspect negotiation, building to the turning point when a hitman became a snitch. Bateson fed Shifty's hope that his car could be returned to his family. He didn't dismiss any of Shifty's banal requests. His was a slow release technique over 3 hours, leading to the punchline, the police could help Shifty, but only if Shifty helped himself. Shifty was evasive at first, yet he threw out hints. The assassin had produced a gun on the way to Marshall's home. He pointed the thing at me and suggested, well, you're coming with me, sort of thing. Shifty said, well, after he pointed this thing, I thought, this is going to be more serious than I fucking thought. He told them he thought he was on a debt collection job. He feared the assassin would shoot the victim in the knees to encourage the repayment of a $200,000 debt. Shifty was spouting nonsense. He was aware police had already identified him as the getaway driver for the assassin's shooting of Jason Moran. Anyone who knew the assassin knew he preferred headshots. The detectives asked about Jason Moran's murder.
I knew that that person, Williams, didn't like him very much, and probably there was a number of people who wanted him dead, him included, Shifty said.
Asked how much a hit on Moran would cost, Shifty said it depended on who wanted it done. He then blurted out, for no apparent reason, that Tony Mockbell had got half a mil on fucking Mick Gatto. This assertion was never proven. Shifty was loosening up. Here was a kind of verbal shimmy, each party sounding out the other. In the car after the Marshall shooting, Shifty had asked whether the assassin shot the victim. I've whispered to him, did ya? And he said, yeah. And I said, where'd you put 'em, the shots? And he said, and then he pointed. He put 'em all over the victim's head, and I've gone, fuck. And then you guys grabbed me. He spoke of discussions with Benji Venuman over a plan to kill Lewis Moran as part of Williams's jihad against the family. He hinted that Venuman had killed Nick Radev. He's a definite possibility you should be looking at. Shifty was asked about the gangland kingpins. There was no top dog, Shifty said. Different players had different pursuits. Fights flared all the time. Tony Mockbell had the most money. Carl Williams was the smartest. Never talked in cars or homes because of bugs. Who was the scariest? Probably Mockbell, because he's got fucking 100 people hanging off him. Mick Gatto could be the next target, or Lewis Moran. Not that Shifty could explain who would fund such a hit, not in the absence of incentives anyway. Shifty imagined he wielded leverage. In an earlier chat with another officer, he had indicated the initials CW. Just free me to be a snitch, he suggested to Bateson, and he would help pin drug charges to Williams. Finally, having led Shifty to hope that he need not spend several decades in jail, Bateson steered him back to reality.
Shifty, you're on remand for murder, he reminded him.
Bateson said he didn't believe Shifty had been surprised when the assassin gunned Marshall down, but he would consider reshaping his view if further information were forthcoming.
As I said to you, Shifty, we're always willing to listen. Always.
Gobbo later said she played a pivotal role in Shifty withstanding undue pressure from the Williams's crew and Tony Mockbell to try to get him to stay silent. The crime bosses suggested a psychiatrist could discredit Shifty if he rolled on his bosses. Gobbo told them that Shifty was not rolling. Bateson has since couched her influence as insignificant. In 2019, he would argue in Royal Commission evidence that Shifty was always going to roll, regardless of his barrister's advice. Yet Shifty's credibility would have been shredded in court if he'd stuck to his role of unwitting accomplice on the way to a debt collection. Bateson had flagged his disbelief to Gobbo after Shifty's first statement. After speaking to Gobbo, Shifty changed his story to make it sound more plausible. Yes, he belatedly declared, he knew he was driving a hitman to murder Michael Marshall. His original claim was then replaced by this updated version of events. His first and conflicting statement ceased to exist. It was scrubbed from the record as if he had never made it. It's likely that Carl Williams dispatched Gobbo to see the assassin after his arrest for the Marshall killing in October 2003. She met the hitman in the Melbourne Custody Centre, an underground facility known as the Submarine for its lack of natural light. Killers have families too, even those who front for a DNA cheek swab, as the assassin once did, with his own shit in his mouth. During his meeting with Gobbo, the assassin rubbed his fingers together in the universal sign for cash. He later said he asked Gobbo to tell Williams that his hit fee should go to his mum, whom he'd saved from being stabbed to death by his father when he was a teenager. Gobbo would dispute the assassin's claim. Her notes at the time recorded the assassin as speaking instead of money stashed at his property, not of hit fees he wanted paid. She later wrote a statement, partly as a defence. If the assassin was telling the truth, Gobbo could have been charged as an accessory to murder after the fact. The assassin would provide 15 statements to police, and Bateson would rate his intelligence as even more critical than Shifty's. The assassin surprised many observers when he rolled on Williams and Mockbell in his first statement about the Marshall killing. The assassin was hardcore and institutionalized. In rolling, he was disobeying the criminal code. He later said he did so because he was miffed that Williams had short-changed his mother on the hit fee. While he was being grilled by Bateson, Shifty named another Williams henchman as a suspect in the Moran and Barbaro killings, an accomplice who soon became the third gangland supergrass. Gobbo represented him too. Like Shifty and the assassin, this client's real identity cannot be published. The European didn't stand out in gangland circles, though his house was firebombed once in an extreme case of vocational stress. The European was close to his lawyer. They had even attended family events together. A detective from the New Piranha Task Force, Detective Senior Constable Peter Kennedy, thought Gobbo's relationship with the European was more than just professional, and had wanted her put under surveillance after Jason Moran's killing. Another close observer wondered why Gobbo was talking to the European so often. "I thought she's either sleeping with him or knows what's going on," the source now says. Phone records show that the European and Gobbo talked on the 21st of June 2003 at 9:33 a.m., about an hour before Jason Moran's death. The European's car E-Tag beeped under a CityLink gantry on the Balti Bridge, about 30 minutes' drive from the Oval, where Moran's kids played footy, at about the same time as the Gobbo call. He and Carl Williams were getting blood tests together, citing a shared desire to lose weight and establishing an alibi for the Jason Moran hit. Gobbo received the European's call while waiting to fly to Bali, after being driven to the airport that morning by her biggest client, Tony Mockbell. Gobbo and the European had also talked at about midnight the night before. They were in constant contact during these weeks. They spoke again after the Moran hit was carried out by the assassin and Shifty. The European would say in Royal Commission evidence in 2020 that Gobbo knew about the impending murder, which he would be convicted of plotting, a claim that seems impossible either to confirm or to disprove. What's undeniable is Gobbo's intimate proximity to the Jason Moran hit that tilted the gangland war. The European also played a part in the downfall of Williams, after Shifty's snitching forced him to do the same. After Gobbo's stroke in July 2004, the European visited her in hospital. He was about to be charged by Bateson for the murder of Jason Moran. Bateson had spoken with him. They met at McDonald's, and the European was considering cooperating with police to reduce his sentence. Her phone conversations with the European made her part of his alibi for Moran's death. Gobbo was never further than a phone call away from murder. Most lawyers are not called before, during, and after the crime. Her purported conversation with the assassin after Marshall's killing framed her as a witness in that murder too. Meanwhile, she was receiving orders from Williams and Mockbell to silence the hitmen. She was acting as a player instead of a lawyer. Conflicted beyond measure, Gobbo shouldn't have represented any of these people. On the 9th of June 2004, Williams was arrested and taken in for questioning about a conspiracy to murder Mario Condello, the Carlton Crew's money man. Williams had been due to go to court the same day to try to alter his bail conditions for drug trafficking charges. It was his last ever day of freedom. Goodbye Mambo shirts, hello prison issue red trackies. His arrest was hailed as an end to the gangland excesses. Had Piranha finally got their main man? Shifty's decision to sell out his associates became public knowledge 2 months later. His real name was published in a newspaper. He was labelled the biggest supergrass since Gianfranco Tozzoni named the purported mafia killers of anti-drugs campaigner Donald McKay in the 1970s. Shifty would have to go into hiding and assume a new name. His snitching had set a precedent and started a domino effect. After Shifty, Gobbo became the lawyer for other supergrasses of gangland, as well as being the lawyer for the gangland bosses they incriminated. She sneakily guided her snitches through conflicting statements, under the direction of Victoria Police. She charged these clients legal fees, even though she was deceiving them. But the complications deepened. The farce of her charade was illustrated when she represented the European as his barrister at a hearing in September 2004. Bateson was in the witness box to be potentially grilled about the changing statements of Shifty, who had by now rolled on the European. The European's defence lawyer should have scythed the changing versions of the truth in Shifty's statements against her client. But the European had a problem. His lawyer was Gobbo. She asked Bateson nothing in court about Shifty's statements. How could she? To do so would expose her unholy collusion with Bateson in amending them. Gobbo had higher priorities than her client's best interests. She had to protect herself. Well, do you think that you gave the European value for money when you appeared for him on that day? Gobbo would be asked at the Royal Commission in 2020. Gobbo replied that she had no recollection of the hearing, though she conceded, I could hardly ask Mr. Bateson a question in which his answer would be to reveal myself. At a bail hearing for the European, Nicola Gobbo did not want her client to get bail. The police wanted the European to be thinking about how he could shed the privations of prison by giving up his mates and cutting his sentence. So Gobbo ensured that her client did not get released. The conflicting demands of this moment were just another everyday conundrum for Gobbo. She needed to masquerade as a staunch defence barrister, but corrupt her courtroom arguments so artfully that neither her client nor the judge noticed. Gobbo was the secret agent pursuing the police's agenda. To this end, she had to hide the growing paper trail that exposed her duplicities. She fixated, understandably, on her anxiety that documents would reveal her mixed loyalties. If they did, she could be killed. Police diaries were the obvious problem. Police officers are bound to fill them with details of conversations and meetings. These are not personal notes, but official records. Defense teams scrutinize these diaries. They also seek transcripts of secret hearings, such as those of the Australian Crime Commission and the Office of the Chief Examiner. These interrogations, under oath, can discredit prosecution witnesses if they reveal discrepancies in their stories. Defense teams study the police briefs of evidence to decipher whether a snitch helped in a police investigation. Police informers are given numbers to denote who they are without revealing their identities. Yet Gobbo's role in these cases never came up at all. The police made certain of it. She didn't appear in these documents. But it wouldn't remain that way. Documents hinting of her double dealing started to grow from about this time in 2004. More and more of them would hint at her unethical behaviour, no matter how carefully she and police tried to mask it. One oversight could bring down the greater conspiracy. These records would come to lurk under the surface like unexploded mines. Bateson helped her out for the committal hearing against the European in 2005. He had expunged her from his diary notes as if she had never existed, so that any subpoenaed material hid her involvement. Gobbo now says she cannot remember her exchanges with Bateson, but accepts she thanked him for hiding her from official scrutiny. In September 2005, Gobbo again consulted Bateson about covering up their conduct in changing Shifty's statement. Lawyer Zara Gard Wilson had spoken of chasing unedited police notes for the upcoming murder trial against her client, Carl Williams. Bateson assured Gobbo that Gard Wilson's subpoena push would be resisted. He also listened as Gobbo explained her official new role as a registered police informer. Gobbo's duplicities in these processes bathed her in extraordinary powers. She held court far beyond the cobblestoned alleyways of Melbourne's CBD. As an agent of police and their star recruitment officer at the Deal or No Deal unit, she could visit prisoners at Barwon Prison, located near Geelong, an hour's drive west of Melbourne, virtually whenever she liked. Her freedom there conjures images of a cloaked governess floating down candlelit corridors to the drip of a leaking tap, of huddled conversations in which the sanctity of life and the taking of it were reduced to numbers games. One of the wardens during the mid-2000s told Dowsley and Carlyon of the goings-on here that should never have occurred. He claims that Gobbo was allowed to enter the prison at any time of the day or night. Piranha police officers ran the prison, the warden says, and placed inmates where they were most susceptible to influence. Gobbo advised her handlers on how best to punish or reward her own clients to encourage them to roll on other prisoners. These practices, which persisted when Gobbo became Informer 3838, had their roots in the years when she was unofficially informing to the Piranha Task Force. Yet little record of this liaison survives because Bateson wrote Gobbo out of his documentation. Her history was unwritten for her own protection. Bateson's erasure was in keeping with police attempts in the years ahead to swaddle Gobbo in an invisibility cloak. Had her cooperation on the Shifty statement been revealed, her intimate relations with Victoria Police would have been exposed years earlier. If she had been shown to be manipulating her clients as well as the justice system, gangland might have exploded with bloody payback, including the death of Gobbo. In one of her first meetings with her official police handlers, Gobbo expressed her fears about reprisals for her assistance to gangland snitches. In the period of acting for Shifty, he turned on half the underworld, Gobbo explained to her handlers in 2005, and that brought considerable stress and pressure to me because I didn't want people to find out that through me he'd gone down that path. I went through the most significant period of paranoia in my life, and I still live in fear of that coming out. Her double dealing had remained undetected. By the start of 2006, though, she faced mounting scrutiny from gangland players about her improper coaching of supergrasses. At the time, Gobbo was guiding the European through the process of turning against Williams as she gave her handlers regular updates on his state of mind. He vacillated between helping police and telling them to fuck off. Gobbo was tempting fate. Tony Mockbell had warned her not to talk to the European. She believed Mockbell would kill her if he discovered she had, and Mockbell could find out from an increasingly suspicious Williams, also doing time in Barwon. Gobbo decided she needed a jailhouse meeting with the European, Williams, and Guard Wilson. Gobbo's bold plan, it seems, was for the European to lie to Williams's face. Williams wouldn't be the only threat to Gobbo at such a meeting. By now, she and Guard Wilson were like repelling magnets tossed into a jar, frenemies who detested one another. The get-together never happened. On the 21st of April 2006, the trial judge, Justice Betty King, called the two lawyers for a meeting. In 2020, Gobbo would recall her panic before the dressing down by King. Had the judge figured out the depth of her deceptions? Not quite. Justice King, renowned for her shows of exasperation, told Gobbo not to represent the European because she had previously represented Shifty, who had rolled on the European. Gobbo was professionally conflicted. How did Gobbo respond? The next day, she went to see the European and continued to advise him to plead guilty and roll on Williams. During the same prison visit, Gobbo spoke with Williams too as a legal advisor. That day, one of Carl's associates was due to be arrested for drug manufacturing. Not knowing Gobbo was the very person who had dobbed him into police. She waited for the newly arrested crook's inevitable phone call as she connived to betray some of the other baddest criminals of gangland. Gobbo retained a note Williams wrote at the time, canvassing options for discrediting the assassin's statement against him. Gobbo had purported to advise Shifty, the assassin, the European, and Williams himself. Professional conflicts aside, she acted against all of them as a police agent, and Williams had almost nutted it out. Gobbo, the accumulator of information, visited Williams again in July. This time, her shtick in plausible deniability failed her. The once trusted advisor was treated with suspicion. As summarized in her account to her handlers, "He's got it in his head that 3838 must have known re the European and lied. He said that everyone is saying that 3838 is a dog and police informer. He had killed for trifling reasons, but Williams was not as one-dimensional as he seemed. Actor Guyton Grantley's caricatured portrayal of him in Underbelly was memorable, but not necessarily true to life. Williams played the buffoon and joked that he was a celebrity with courtroom reporters. He was open-mouthed and bug-eyed when he was convicted of the Marshall killing in November 2005. Yet that wasn't the full picture. People have this view of Carl that he's like the character in Underbelly, says a lawyer close to the events at the time. That's nothing like him. He was a really smart guy. He's the guy who would make 200 phone calls a day. He wouldn't tell anyone anything. He'd never give anyone up. But he'd put all of those pieces, all those chats together, and he'd create a pretty real picture of what was happening. The bad news for Gobbo? Williams now wanted to destroy her. The good news? Williams put aside his guns for hire and picked up a pen. He wrote letters. In one, to an associate, he described Gobbo as a double-dealing snake. He said she'd advised Shifty and the European to make full statements to police to try and put us in prison for a long time, if not forever. To put it bluntly, she is a dog, and I will show her up for what she is. I believe people have a right to know, he wrote. I don't declare people unless I'm 100% sure. In this case, I am 1,000,000% sure. Williams wrote to his trial judge, Justice King. He wrote to the legal ombudsman to say that Gobbo had acted improper and unethical in regards to a matter that involves myself. In regards to Gobbo, I am 100% correct. As much as I didn't want to think I was right, the writing was on the wall. Williams wrote to a friend in August 2006. I had a lot of time for Gobbo and stuck up for her quite a lot of the time with different people. Gobbo admitted to Malad that she told or advised the European to go with police and make statements against me and others. Williams sent further letters to the Director of Public Prosecutions and the Law Institute. Roberta Williams also wrote letters demanding an official review of Gobbo's legal conduct. She acted unofficially too. She rang Gobbo and called her a cunt. Williams's letters triggered an inquiry into Gobbo's behaviour, but no disciplinary action resulted. Legal observers now express surprise that he was unable to expose Gobbo's conflicts. His claims certainly had merit. Even stranger, Williams and Gobbo had kept speaking during his poison letters campaign against her. Both had sought to milk the other for information in a relationship best described as keeping your enemies close. Shifty pleaded guilty to the Marshall killing. When he was sentenced to a minimum of just 10 years, on the 19th of January 2005, Supreme Court Justice Bernie Teague said his cooperation had been of enormous value. His was a generous deal that, to this day, leaves observers wondering at notions of justice. The upside was undeniable. Without Shifty's statements, as edited by Gobbo, Williams might never have been charged with 6 murders. Yet Shifty's statements didn't always sound true. His evidence in a trial for the murder of Mark Marlia was dismissed by a magistrate in July 2007 as greatly and almost totally unreliable. The 3 defendants were accused of torturing Marlia with a soldering iron after Marlia was lured to a house in Laylaw in Melbourne's north. Similar scepticism greeted some of the statements of Mr. Average, the assassin, and the European. Their evidence landed convictions. But their credibility in the witness box brings to mind the Anchorman, the legend of Ron Burgundy movie line, about a repugnant cologne called Sex Panther. 60% of the time, it works every time. The European eventually offered 14 statements about gangland goings-on. He claimed insights into the Hodson killings. He spoke of a confession to Victor Pierce's murder in 2002, linked to Benji Venuman and his associate Farouk Orman. He talked a lot about Mockbell, with whom he went a long way back, and Williams. Some of his claims were probably true. Gangland killer Evangelos Ange Gousis did not cooperate with police like the others. They got on the bus, as Justice Betty King once put it, while Gousis got run over by the bus. Gousis was jailed for 2 gangland murders on the evidence of another informer, Jack Price, a triple murderer known to lie. Gousis was convicted of the killings of Lewis Kane, the partner of Guard Wilson, and Lewis Moran. Detective Inspector Gavin Ryan, then head of Piranha, once said in court Jack Price would sell his own mother down the river. Gousis coined the deal-or-no-deal labour for Barwon's Acacia unit, where hitmen and drug traffickers lined up to barter for their freedom. In a thoughtful 2014 letter released to the press, he claimed their statements were induced and often unreliable. I'm not for 1 minute suggesting that the gangland war was something that didn't need to be addressed, Gousis wrote.
Of course, it had to be investigated and stopped. It put a lot of people in danger, and it created a lot of tension in the general community. But it's what developed from this that has to be investigated. The process police adopted in the way they gathered their evidence and the way they collaborated with witnesses and coached them to get their story right in order to secure a conviction. The assassin was sentenced to jail until 2029. It appears that Gobbo did not guide him through the rolling process, though investigations are ongoing. 14 years after his arrest for murder in 2003, the assassin's evidence was still being used in gangland trials. He would give evidence against Stephen Asling, another underworld hardnut, convicted in 2017 for the 2003 shooting of Graham Kinnebrough. The reliability of the assassin's evidence was challenged during Asling's trial, but he would have been framed as a liar had the police produced Gobbo's statement about their conflicting accounts concerning their conversation about money in his post-arrest meeting after the Michael Marshall killing. They didn't. Shifty may live among us. It's unclear whether he has been released back into the world he menaced, masquerading as another bloke you wouldn't notice if he walked past. He may go straight, or resume a lifetime of choices that, as one lawyer put it, mark him as a psychopath. The European was sentenced to 23 years on the 27th of September 2006, but got out of prison after about 10. He may live next door to you. How would you know? For helping police, he was granted a new name to replace his old name, which cannot be published anyway. Like Shifty, the assassin, and Gobbo, the tricky parts of the European's history officially never happened.